Now, here's Woody Allen on the Akedah. It's a good way to start our last Akedah. Okay. But at the last minute, the Lord stayed Abraham's hand and said, "How could thou doest such a thing?" And Abraham said, "But thou said." "Never mind what I said," the Lord spake. "Doest thou listen to every crazy idea that comes thy way?" And Abraham grew ashamed. Not really, no. "I jokingly suggest that thou sacrificed Isaac, and thou immediately runs out to do it." Abraham fell to his knees. "See, I never know when you're kidding." And the Lord thundered, "No sense of humor. I can't believe it. But doth this not prove that I love thee, that I was willing to donate my only son on thy whim?" And the Lord said, "It proves that some men will follow any order, no matter how asinine, as long as it comes from a resonant, well-modulated voice." And with that, the Lord bid Abraham get some rest and check with him tomorrow. So that's Woody Allen's take on the Akedah. all right. Now, two more comments on the Akedah. Two more takes on the Akedah, rather, is one is from a rabbi who talks about the idea that Abraham is testing God. What he says is several things. First of all, why is it that not only does Abraham never protest what God says, but also never accepts it? Abraham never says, "Okay," never says, "I'll do it," never says, "I understand the command." He just does it and awaits God's action, so to speak. God tells him to do it. He says, specifically, I propose that God was testing Abraham's willingness to refuse to commit murder, even while commanded by God to do so. That is, God wants him to refuse, and Abraham wants God to stop him. Second, that Abraham went along with that command with the faith that in the end he would not be required to do so, and not with the intent to consummate Isaac's murder, though he was prepared to if God insisted. And third, that Abraham was rewarded for his faith that God really doesn't need or want child sacrifice. So the way he reads the story, and I won't go through the whole article, is as follows. God tells Abraham in the hopes that Abraham won't do it, because as God shows at the end, it's not something God wants. That's a little hard to sustain. We'll talk about that in a second. But the other idea, which is not so uncommon, is that Abraham wants God to stop him and is waiting for God to stop him. And here, I have an article, of course. There's so much on the Akedah, it's just ridiculously overwhelming. Where's my other article? An article that argues that goes through all the promises that God made to Abraham previously and says that through Isaac, remember when he kicks Ishmael out of the house, what does God say to him? "Don't worry, because through Isaac you will become a great nation." So Abraham knows that God has already promised him that. And therefore, according to this reading, which is an interesting one, oh, here it is, although not a certain one, he says that I want to give it to you in his words if I can find it, but I can't. He says that therefore Abraham must have known that God couldn't consummate this without breaking God's own word. Right? So Abraham carried this out as a test of God's fidelity to God's own word. And again, Abraham was prepared to do it, although according to this rabbi, had God let him go through with it, no one can see you, it's okay. You can't dress with like a colorful scarf and a colorful skirt and then right and run by and think. I'm sorry. So he says that Abraham therefore knew that God would be breaking God's own promise, and Abraham was prepared to do it, but according to this article at least, which is called Abraham Trusted That God Would Stop Him, had God not stopped him, that would have been the end of their relationship. And along these lines, and this is something that several of you have brought up, but I've saved it, discussion of it till now. One of the things that is most interesting about the Akedah is what happens after. two things about the Akedah I want to mention in terms of what happens after the Akedah. One, you don't have to look at the text, but the other we do. The first is that after the Akedah, Abraham and God never speak again. Abraham and Isaac never speak again. So the question is, and remember that at the very end, who comes down the mountain? Abraham alone, which is why you get all these midrashim that he really was killed and resurrected. I forgot to bring one other book that I meant to bring, but I'll talk about it in a second. And as a result, some rabbis argue that this was a break in the relationship, not only between Abraham and Isaac, but between Isaac and God. Between Abraham and Isaac, and also between Abraham and God. Yeah. The passing on of it's nice. It's a nice idea. There's a whole book, in fact, by a psychoanalyst named Theodore Reich, who says this whole thing is an initiation ritual about Isaac's. You know, it's if you will a circumcision, but for an adult initiation ritual. And he goes around the world anthropologically and shows what they do with adolescent boys. He assumes that Isaac's an adolescent, but I don't remember, since I read part of it, and I read it a long time ago, whether he talks about the sadness of the parent in, you know, which you don't get as much today in a bar and bat mitzvah because the kids still aren't adult. But there is a, I remember when my older brother was about 14 or 15 years old. I remember that we were, I don't know if we were around the dinner table or something, and he said to my father, they both stood up, and he said to my father with a little bit of shock, you know, I hope this doesn't bother you, but I actually think I'm taller than you are. And my father said, Steve, it's okay, no parent ever minds when their child grows taller than they are, which was the right answer, but may not be the truth, right? So it may be, you're right, Abraham was God's only guy. And now all of a sudden it's Isaac.
And Abraham says to Isaac, when Isaac asks where is the sacrifice, right. Abraham says
God will provide. Right.
So maybe Abraham believed all along that he would be.
Well, that's what he says. He says when Abraham, right.
I feel like that helped Isaac to believe that God will bind Isaac
to God. It's a lovely idea that's the real binding that's going on. And the comment that he says God will provide the sacrifice is one of the pieces of evidence that this rabbi uses to say that it really was, you know, that all along he knew what was going to happen. Yeah.
One midrash that I heard said that Isaac was actually older. He wasn't just an
37.
He was 37.
That's not, yeah, that's how the rabbis determine if, in fact, Sarah dies at right after the Akedah, then that's how old Isaac has to be.
Okay. So he has lived at home this whole time. He was a mama's boy. He was, you know, mm-hmm. You don't even hear about him because he's so quiet, and yeah. It sounds like he doesn't want to leave home, and maybe this is way, and here Abraham, his father,
is forcing him out of the house.
He's forcing him out of the house, seriously. But if he says he wouldn't, he's forcing him to...
If you don't get a job, I'll kill you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is the only way they could get him to really believe that...
That's an interesting way of thinking about thinking about what the Akedah is really about. But it does still leave us with that interesting fact, whether it's of commission or omission, that they never speak again. The next time Isaac and Abraham have contact is when Isaac comes to bury him.
Right.
Yeah.
I heard two interesting and a little bit off the wall interpretations on Isaac. One was he was a child born late in life, and it's possible he was actually a special needs.
Yeah. People have said that before, that because the reason that they say that about Isaac, well, think about it for a second. Before you get to the second interpretation, think about this for a second with Isaac. The reason that people say that is, again, the only things that we know about Isaac, The only things that we're really told, he never left the land of Israel. He's the only one of the patriarchs that never left. He digs the wells that his father dug. In other words, he's just repeating his father's actions. And the only real adult episode of Isaac's life is when he's fooled by, because he's old and blind, by his son into thinking that Jacob is Esau. And remember that he favors Esau, who is vital and alive and hunts and so on. So you could make that profile if you wanted to.
And then he couldn't even choose his own wife. Somehow.
Right. Somebody else chose his wife for him.
But the second interpretation was that the test of Akedah was actually a punishment for him for having kicked Ishmael. He was the one who initiated kicking Ishmael out of the house.
Yeah, if you remember, this was a long time ago, but if you remember the whole episode with Hagar, we asked who did it, and everybody had a different view. One said it was Abraham, one said it was Hagar, one said it was... You could do the same thing with the kicking of Ishmael out of the house. Was it Isaac who told on him? Was it Abraham? Was it Hagar? Although it seems like Sarah is the motive force, you can certainly make that case. And you can put those two cases together and say that if you have a kid who is a special needs kid, and you have another kid who's a rough kid, you want to get that rough kid away from him as soon as possible. Now, while I want to say I'm not entirely comfortable with the blasphemous feeling of calling one of the patriarchs a special needs kid, but you could actually turn it around, and you could say that what we're talking about is spiritual stature, and in fact, it makes a point about spiritual stature if you make that case that not every patriarch has to be a giant of intellect to be a giant of spirit. Why not? So it depends how you spin it, but I don't want to, I just want to be careful going on record on that one. So
what meaning did you put to the fact that there was silence between these?
Well, I didn't put any meaning to it, although others have, that the relationship was broken by this event. And that's why it was not only broken between Abraham and Isaac, but broken between Abraham and God. However, the second point that I did want to make before we get to the sort of general overviews is what happens right after. If you open up to, again, chapter 22, okay. Start with verse 19. It says, Abraham then returned to his servants, and they departed together for Beersheba. And Abraham stayed in Beersheba. Okay, so first of all, not just does it say that Abraham went, it sounds like Abraham's staying alone, which is why, according to rabbinic tradition, does anyone know where Isaac went? I mentioned it, I think, last time. He went to study in yeshiva, right? At the yeshiva of Shem Ve'ever. Don't worry about that, but anyway, so that's the tradition. No, what? No, it doesn't say in the Torah, it says it in the rabbinic commentaries.
Oh, okay.
There were no yeshivas yet. Sometime now, but look at this, look at the coda to this. Sometime later, Abraham was told, Milcah too has borne children to your brother Nahor. Uz the firstborn, Buz his brother, Kemuel the father of Aram, Chesed, Chazo, Pildas, Jidlaf, it's easier in the Hebrew, I gotta tell you. And Bituel being the father of Rebekah. These eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother, and his concubine, whose name was Reumah, also bore children Teba, Gaham, Tahash, and Ma'akah. Now, usually, in every interpretation except for one that I'm aware of, the reason for this genealogy is what? Why do you need this genealogy? Who's important in it?
Rebecca.
You got to know where Rebecca came from, okay? And that's why at the end of the Akedah there is this genealogy. But Soloveitchik has what I think is a brilliant comment on it, and actually, in some ways, makes the Akedah more poignant. It's not just, you're not just given the genealogy, right? If you're given the genealogy, that's one thing. Then it's for the reader. But what's the first sentence of this genealogy? Abraham was told. In other words, the genealogy is not for you; it's for Abraham. So here Abraham has just gone through the Akedah. He struggled for a century to get one child. Mm-hmm. He almost lost that child. And what is he told right after? By the way, your brother had this one. Mm-hmm. And he's learning how, first of all, fundamentally unfair such things are. Just because you're righteous doesn't mean you're going to have a large family, and someone else, because they're not righteous, is going to have a small one. Doesn't work that way. And Second, he is now going to appreciate in a new way what he almost lost, because this is all he gets, even though other people get lots. This is it. So I never noticed the power and poignancy of that genealogy, but you can imagine how painful this must be for Abraham, that all of a sudden, you know, he struggles to get this one kid, and the rest of his family are having child after child after child. It also, by the way, puts in a different light the promise that God made to him. When he says, you'll be like the stars of the heavens and the sands of the earth, doesn't seem to be working out that way. In fact, it seems like the other nations, his brother, who has no connection to Judaism, is going to be like the stars of the heavens and the sands of the earth. So there is built into the promise its opposite. God says one thing, but it seems like another is happening, which is really a very powerful statement right here at the outset. All right, so let me, yeah, please.
Earlier you mentioned that one of the problems that Abraham was having in this reminding of was if this then that, and he couldn't believe that God would lie.
Why couldn't he believe that God would lie? Well, it's an interesting question. There is a long tradition of discussion in philosophy, Jewish philosophy, Christian philosophy, I'm sure Muslim philosophy, though I'm not familiar with it, that talks about whether God commands things because they are good or whether they're good because God commands them. We don't have to get into that now, but the assumption of the Torah is that God doesn't violate God's own rules. That if God says it's bad to lie, then it's bad for God to lie too. And if God doesn't, and if God does lie, then you have to give an explanation for why. That doesn't do it. Now, God does lie in the Torah, by the way. Although lie is a very harsh word, but I don't know how else to put it. Not only does God, well, I wouldn't say God advises people to lie even more. Mm-hmm. When Samuel is going off to anoint David, and he is afraid that Saul will kill him, God says to him, well, go say that you came to sacrifice an animal, which is a lie. That's not why he came. So the commentators try to say, well, he sacrificed an animal too, but it's clear that God is advising, right? That God is advising him to save his own neck by telling an untruth. So, and the same thing, you know, the story with Sarah, where he says, you know, where she says, how could I have a kid with my husband so old? And God repeats it as saying, you know, I'm so old, how could I have a kid, to Abraham, so that Abraham won't know that Sarah said, you know, you're a codger. So I would say, yes, it's maybe true that God's not bound by what we think of as truth, but when God deviates from it, it's hard for people and they have to try to find a reason for it. Yeah.
I just wanted to have a quick understanding. Various positions that the rabbis over the centuries have taken on the meaning of the Akedah,
yes,
as opposed to just one.
The predominant, yeah, we have. And we've talked about a lot of them along the way. Let me give you two or three essential summaries, and then I would say what is the modern position. The traditional position of the Akedah was pretty clear, I have to say. I mean, even though it's not my favorite interpretation, the traditional position was God was testing Abraham's faith, and Abraham came through. It's that simple. That God asked of Abraham the worst possible sacrifice, and Abraham did it because Abraham trusted God, not because he wanted to, but the fact that he did it so willingly proves how much he trusted God. Okay, that's the predominant interpretation. And if you think about it for a minute, okay, in one way, the only way to object to that interpretation, it's a big way, but it's the only way, is to assume that human values, and it goes back to exactly what you just said, to assume that human values trump what God says, right? Unless you assume that Abraham was delusional, right? That's the other possibility. But But if you assume that God really said this, if you trust the text that God said this, the only way to say that Abraham shouldn't have done it is if you assume that what we believe has to take priority over what God commands. I mean, let's say, think about this for a minute. Let's say that God really did come to you and told you to do that. You could have, and if you refused, you could have one of two refusals. You could either say, I don't care what the head of the universe says, it's wrong. What the creator of all life says, it's wrong. I decide. Or you could say, I'm too weak to carry it out, even though I know that, which is what I think a lot of us would say. In theory, I understand God's the creator of all life, God gets to pick, but I can't do it. Go ask Abraham. But other than that, you have to argue either that Abraham is delusional or that human beings know what's good better than God does. So the traditional interpretation does have a lot to be said for it if you assume that God is the creator of all life. Yeah.
Look at the price Abraham had to pay by showing yeah. his faith in God. He lost his son, and soon thereafter he lost his wife.
Yes.
And she was just so distraught.
Well, she also was over 100 years old.
Well, I understand. But so was he.
Yeah, so was he.
He was even older.
So if that's the price...
It's a huge price.
It is if you assume, which you could assume, that the things were related. The rabbis relate them. The Bible doesn't relate them. Rabbis do. The Bible only relates them by proximity. But yeah, that's true.
We're talking about Abraham as through our eyes as a human being. And you just mentioned, Abraham had a miserable life. What is the significance of this promise to a miserable person that has
well,
all these issues?
I wouldn't say...
going to, have your descendant...
I don't want to characterize Abraham's life as miserable. I would characterize it as follows. It says, Berech Avraham Bakol, God blessed Abraham with everything. And Harold Kushner has a wonderful comment on that. He said, Abraham really did get everything. He saw all of life. He saw joy, he saw tragedy. He saw wealth, he saw poverty. He had a home, but he traveled. All the things. He had a son, he lost a son. That's Ishmael, not Isaac. So I really think that, in a deep sense, Abraham had a wonderful life because it was redeemed by the fact that he had an intimate relationship with God. But he had a difficult life. He clearly had a difficult life. I would like to substitute difficult for miserable, and difficult isn't necessarily bad. Lawrence of Arabia had a difficult life. He had a wonderful life, but he had a difficult life. I don't know. I'm not sure. It depends. Goethe said, the great German poet and philosopher said, you only know the beginning of your life at the end of it. None of us know what happened in our childhood until we're much older. So if you had come to Abraham at the end of his life and said, looking back on it, would you change it? I don't know that he would.
But what message is God giving Abraham by this promise?
I don't know. I haven't really thought about it, but I'll say that the message might be that, and this is a message that actually applies to the Jewish people through the centuries, that if you follow this path, your life will be difficult but rewarding, as opposed to, empty and fine. As Voltaire said, better a philosopher unsatisfied than a pig satisfied. So,
very professional.
Yeah. So,
The question is that if then by having, knowing the fact that you're going to multiply, and is that in your opinion, is that?
I think for Abraham to know that he founded something that would last and he would be the head of a great people, especially in that time, that was the greatest thing you could hope for. Right? Assuming everyone dies, what do you hope for? You hope for to be remembered and to found a great people, and especially back then. That he was going to be the head of a great people. Without leaving the afterlife aside, I don't know what else any of us can hope for. So,
I guess I'm relating personally to the part of letting go and learning to let go. When you talk about the difficulty that most of us are faced with letting go of our
children. Yes.
Maybe it's not as crucial as putting a knife to their throat.
Right.
I remember pushing my daughter to go
right.
literally in the airport. she wanted to go. Last minute, she said, Mom, maybe I shouldn't. And I'm saying, no, you are going. Right. And then I cried.
Right.
So we are faced with those moments where we have to make those choices to put them
in
and cut the cord.
Right. So, yeah. I agree. Yeah. Yes. I mean, on this interpretation, Abraham was playing chicken. Abraham was James Dean, you know, in that great scene with the cars. Yeah, he was playing chicken to see whether God would push him over the edge or not. And in the end, obviously, God, you know, draws back, which leads to the second interpretation. I said the first was the classical one. The second predominant interpretation, and this really grew up more in modern times than in ancient times, is that the point of this story is to show that God doesn't accept human sacrifice. That's the whole point, is that other gods accept human sacrifice. You may think, Abraham, that this God does, but decisively at the end, God says, what I want from you is the devotion that would lead you to do such a thing, but I would never want you to actually do such a thing. And in here, in this, let me make the analogy of prayer. I had a teacher, I don't remember which teacher it was that said this to us, but I've thought of it many, many times, who talked about that when the temple was destroyed, people substituted prayer for sacrifice. And he said, prayer is a very pale substitute for sacrifice. I mean, think about it. You take an animal, your animal that you've grown from the time you were young, and you say to God, I give this to you, and before your eyes, the animal is slaughtered and burnt, and that goes up to God in some sense, and that's your offering. Now compare that to standing in a synagogue and holding a book and moving back. It's nothing, but the whole point of prayer is to be able to have the same kind of internal experience that you have when you sacrifice. And that's what God is teaching Abraham here. Yeah.
My question is, how did we get from sacrificing the animal to where we are today?
By the destruction of the temple. It's that simple. If the temple were still around, you would still, and people who pray for restoration of the temple pray for restoration of sacrifices. It was, I hate to, well, you know what this reminds me of? Okay, I'll tell you a story.
It's such a jump. I mean, in our
Max Vorspan of blessed memory, who, by the way, whose granddaughter is married to our incoming rabbi, Ehud Sella, who is going to be our new rabbi come July. But Max Vorspan was a professor at the University of Judaism. So he was, it is fair to say, a religious liberal. And I remember once he was speaking, introducing or speaking right before Adin Steinsaltz, the great Israeli Talmudist, who it is fair to say is a religious conservative. I mean, they were on the opposite sides of the... And before Steinsaltz spoke, I don't remember why Max was talking about this, but he got up and he said, the destruction of the temple was the greatest thing that ever happened to the Jewish people. Because not only did it stop sacrifices, which are primitive, but it dispersed us throughout the world so that we could influence the rest of the world. Now, Tisha B'Av is a day of mourning for the destruction of the temple. And traditionally, you pray for the restoration of the temple. And I was looking at Steinsaltz's face. He was just aghast that any rabbi would say that the destruction of the temple was a good thing when it's commemorated before the Holocaust was considered universally the greatest tragedy that ever befell the Jewish people. But that's what put an end to sacrifices, like it or not. It was that abrupt. One day there were, next day there weren't. Right.
And number two, that we have no control over the
people. Well,
but also here it says that following his word, that he says, you know, Abraham playing chicken, if God knows that has been predetermined, then obviously God knows where
this thing should be. Well, this, the question has come up before in our class, and will come up endless times. There is no, I mean, again, we could spend a whole semester on this topic, which has been discussed a great deal in not only in Jewish tradition, but in general philosophical tradition, the question of determinism. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because you can't come to a resolution. There are all sorts of different views on it. Rabbi Akiva is the one that people usually quote. He says, "Hakol tzafui v'harishut netunah," which means everything is foreseen, but free will is given, which is a way of saying you don't understand the two, but that's what we're taught. There was really, to my knowledge, there was only one, really one eminent Jewish authority who was a pretty thoroughgoing determinist, so the Izbiter Rebbe, the Meshiloach. Even though, a fascinating personality, but he was the only real determinist that I can think of. And I'll give you one other interesting view. This is much simplified, but a medieval philosopher, Gersonides, he tried to get out of it this way. He said, God knows everything that can be known. Therefore, only things that exist can be known. To ask God to know something that doesn't exist is like asking God to know a unicorn. Since there is no unicorn, you can't ask God to know it. It just doesn't make any sense, right? The future doesn't exist. So to ask God to know it is asking God to know something that isn't. And God can't know something that isn't any more than people can know. So it's just impossible. So God can make good calculations based on previous trends, but God can't know the future because the future doesn't exist. Now, I don't want to argue the point. Other people argue the point. This is, I'm telling you, if you really want to go into this, you can enter this labyrinth and never leave. But the point is, the way the Bible is read by the rabbis and by its readers is that predictions are made that come to pass, but people still have free will. Because you can, I mean, look, you can say this, if Moses got the Torah at Sinai, why was there a rebellion from Korach in the book of Numbers? Didn't Moses know Korach was going to rebel? No end to this question. Yeah.
I was wondering, is sacrifice gone altogether? Because some traditions, some cultures still...
Sacrifice is gone from the Jewish people. The Samaritans, all 12 of them, still sacrifice each year. I mean, however, they're a very small number, but... And there are other tribes probably that sacrifice, but there is no animal sacrifice among Jews.
Is it forbidden now, or is it?
Well, you only sacrificed in the temple, so I don't think anybody even considered sacrificing elsewhere. Yeah.
How about the kapur
that? Well, you don't. But that's not. You swing a chicken around, but you don't slaughter the chicken to God, right? And even that, some people object to, but the idea is not to kill the chicken by swinging it to give it to God. The idea is, you know, that you swing a dead chicken around for some superstition. There are a lot of superstitions. There are a lot of superstitions. Yes, a lot of people still do it. There are a lot of superstitions, but there is no official animal sacrifice. Yeah.
In the tradition, after the Jews left, the temple was destroyed, was there ever a movement to return for Jews to gather and build another temple, or did they take it?
Not till modern times, no.
The diaspora simply was what it was.
Yeah, because God had to do it. God had to do it until Zionism, right, until Zionism. Okay, so, yes?
You mentioned that after this, the relation between God and Abraham was disconnected, or they never...
All I said was, I want to be careful, all I said was they never speak again in the Bible. Some interpreters say that their relationship was broken, others don't. But all I know, I'm just reporting the facts, which is that the two of them never speak again, and Abraham and Isaac never speak again. And what happens right after that is that Abraham, I mean, we'll get to this next time, what happens after that is the negotiation for a piece of land after Sarah dies. Yes?
It seems to me in a certain way Isaac really is sacrificed. My interpretation is that never really comes down. This is like child abuse, and it's affected him for life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And even though he's still physically alive, a part of him has been sacrificed for this whole process.
I think that it is certainly a plausible modern reading, and a lot of moderns have read it that way. Especially because Isaac clearly, in some ways, lives a stunted life in the Bible. Now, interestingly, if you ask modern biblical scholars as opposed to religious scholars, not the same thing, people who just study the Bible professionally but don't necessarily have any religious commitment, several of them write that they think that there are an Isaac scroll missing, that there were Isaac stories, but those stories are missing from the Bible. There's no way of knowing. They're just comparing it to all the stories. There are so many stories about Jacob, so many stories about Abraham, and Isaac, you got almost nothing. But if you take it as written, there's something about Isaac's life that doesn't add up. The only other story we have about Isaac is where he, which we'll read, is where he does the same thing Abraham does. He passes his wife off as his sister. So there is none of the dynamism, none of the power. I mentioned before that my father years ago gave a sermon about Isaac where he talks about Abraham Mendelssohn. Abraham Mendelssohn was a very successful banker. His father was Moses Mendelssohn, the famous Jewish philosopher, the founder of the Jewish Enlightenment, one of the most important men of his time. His son was Felix Mendelssohn, the great composer. So Abraham Mendelssohn said, the first half of my life, I was the child of my father. The second half of my life, I was the father of my child. I mean, he was important in his own way, but he was nothing compared to the people on both sides, and my father compared that to Isaac. The first half of Isaac's life, he was the son of Abraham. The second half of his life, he was the father of Jacob, who becomes Israel. And there is something to that, that Isaac is the link between generations, but he himself, you know, and maybe this is why. Maybe the Akedah explains it. I don't know.
And maybe that's one of the meanings of the silence, that it's not necessarily that it was a disconnection, but everything was in the open, and there was no need for further words, that it was set to motion.
Well, that's an interesting thought, how you view the silence. I mean, their silence comes from lots of different things. There's an easy silence, a loving silence, a silence of absolute horror, you know? I don't know. Yes, all sorts of things. So I don't know what Isaac's silence is, or Abraham's after this. You know, remember, I'll tell you in a second. Yeah.
What?
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, our rabbi at home, his sermon on the Akedah a couple of years ago, was that Abraham was actually a very abusive parent. The fact that he would, I mean, yes, he did show his faith in God by doing this, but today he would be sent to jail for doing this traumatizing.
This is an interesting question. If he would be sent to jail today, does that mean he was an abusive parent then? Well, it's a tricky thing to use today's standards. That, I mean, look, he'd be sent to jail already for having slaves. Well, before he ever got to Isaac.
Yeah.
But when you say, but that's the point is that they're, you know, to some extent, you have to read in the time, although we do, I mean, granted, we move back and forth all the time. But about the abusive parent issue, there was a David Blumenthal, I think, who's a professor of Judaic studies at Emory, wrote a book the subtitle is The Abusive God, where he talks about all through the Bible how God acts like an abusive parent. So you could certainly read it that way. Obviously, this is not a book that won accolades among the traditional community, but the whole point of the story is that Abraham is abusive. I mean, that's, if Abraham isn't abusive, the point is that he's compelled by God to be abusive, and abusive is wrong, and if it wasn't wrong, there'd be no story.
He was punished worse than being sent to jail.
But you keep saying that. All I'm saying is that's a midrash. That's not in the Bible. We don't know that. We don't know that. All we know is that the Bible doesn't say that Abraham and Isaac spoke again. But we just have to be careful about distinguishing what our interpretation is from what the Bible says. Maybe he lost his son. That is one way of looking at it, and maybe he lost his wife. But you could also argue that, you know, they were apart for a time, they saw each other, the Bible doesn't report on it, which is why Isaac came to bury him after he died.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe that was the forgiveness.
Maybe it was. I just want us to be clear about what it is we're bringing to the text and what it is the text is bringing to us.
Right.
Yeah.
I worked for a little while as a shepherd in Israel, and one day they went to slaughter a goat.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be there. Part of my life I've been a vegetarian, and I mean, we don't think about it when we go to the store to buy something that's plastic wrapped, but
right.
Really we are sacrificing animals all the time so that we live.
Right. This is actually the justification that I sometimes give for sacrifice. I say when people get upset about sacrifice in ancient times, most of the sacrifices were eaten. Not all, but most were eaten. So if you eat meat, which I don't, you know, that's not so different. But I had no idea we had a shepherd in the class. How perfect. That is perfect.
Is his name David?
Norm?
My question is an obvious one. We've learned about what the traditionalists said about the Akeda. We learned what the modernists say about the Akeda. We learned about what seculars say about the Akeda. What does Rabbi Goldberg do?
Yeah, that's what Mark asked me that last time, and I promised him I would say. And you're right, too. That's what they're all right. No. So I would say this, that I would like to believe that Abraham was testing God, but I don't believe it, because it says the one phrase that he actually doesn't even bring up in his article, which seems to me to disprove his whole article, is verse 10, where it says, V'yishlach Avraham et yado, v'yikach et ma'achelet, lishchot et beno, which means Abraham picked up the knife to kill his son. That's why he picked up the knife. It doesn't say Abraham picked up the knife, you know, hoping that God would. And I wish that one phrase makes the story so difficult for me. And so what I believe is this. First of all, I believe that for Abraham, although this was a test, it wasn't such a big test. And the reason it wasn't such a big test, I mean, it was a big test, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't such a big test because he lived in a world in which child sacrifice was real. People did kill their kids. Children were sacrificed. We found the altars outside of Jerusalem, right outside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. They found altars where people, you know, where Canaanites and others sacrificed children. This wasn't, I mean, we found it as late as the 14th, 15th century in South America. You know that. It was just an article a little while ago about one of the tribes, I don't remember, the Mayans. I don't remember if it was the Mayans they found. Was it the Mayans? They found, you know, altars for child sacrifice. So I'm sure it was a huge test. But Abraham comes out against the background of a culture where child sacrifice is not unheard of. Let me put it that way. So when God tells him to do it, I think Abraham completely believes that God wants him to do it. There's no reason not to. Even though the Bible is filled with comments against child sacrifice, there are also comments that show that child sacrifice was an ancient practice that leaves, I mean, and this is the whole theme of John Levinson's book, The Scholar at Harvard, Resurrection of the Beloved Son. He shows that child sacrifice was clearly practiced, and maybe even before the time of the Bible, there were Israelite ancestors or precursors who practiced it too. We don't know. So that's point one. So was it a trial for Abraham? Yes, absolutely. And the sacrifice was real. But then God says, I don't want that. And then the rest of the Bible several times talks about child sacrifice being bad. So I think that it is supposed to serve two purposes. You're supposed to believe that Abraham was asked to do this and was willing to do it because when God asks you to do something, whatever it is, you should be willing to do it. Anything. I think that lesson is clearly supposed to, I'm just going to be a second, all hands, is clearly supposed to be there. And you can't minimize it. But I also think that it is true that God is making a declaration here. I am actually different from the surrounding gods. And I don't want you to assume that what I will ask of you is equivalent to what other gods will ask of you. Because all the other commands against child sacrifice, even though there is one other, remember, there's one other instance of child sacrifice with Yiftach, but I'll come to that in a second. All the other commands against child sacrifice say that this, you know, the background of this is such a thing is not permitted. So I think those two messages are supposed to come through. The one child sacrifice that exists is Yiftach in the book of Judges. But the book of Judges is all about how people who otherwise are unworthy can still be leaders. Samson is a boorish adolescent, but he becomes the leader of Israel. And Yiftach is a war leader. And, you know, they're all, many of the judges, not all, but they're almost all not really up to snuff. But the point is God can use almost anyone for God's purposes. So that's how I see the Akedah. But I also see it, and I don't want to minimize this, as a literary masterpiece, as one of the great stories of human history, which is why you could spend session after session after session talking about it. Okay, one, two. Different though. I appreciate what you're saying, but it's not the same. This was a religious belief that the parent or the priest kills the child because God will only be appeased by the death of a child. It's different from saying, I'm going to use a child for a pragmatic means, and if they die in that, they become holy and go to heaven, even though that's terrible on its own. But real child sacrifice is gone from the world, at least as far as I know, in its purest state. Right.
Father is an idol worshiper.
Right.
And so somewhere in Abraham growing up with this, as his father, this final...
It's the end of the pagan...
The beginning of a whole new era.
And that actually leads to two comments, one I made before and the other by Maimonides, which is a beautiful way to wrap this up, actually, and goes back to Max Warspan. Everybody ties together. So... The first is that, remember last time I said, why was this a test for Abraham and not for Isaac? And the Tosefet Bracha answered, because Abraham is a tzaddik, is a righteous man, but he's the son of a wicked man. Whereas Isaac is a righteous man who's the son of a righteous man. So Isaac understood what was going on. Abraham had to reach his own understanding, had to achieve it by himself. You know, it's like if you're the son of a star in Hollywood, you have a leg up. You know everybody in the business already, right? Then you're expected to be able to do things. But if you come from the boonies, you have to make it on your own. The second about Maimonides is this. Maimonides has a revolutionary and very controversial explanation of animal sacrifice. And the reason it's revolutionary and controversial is it seems to suggest that one day we won't need animal sacrifice. His interpretation of why God asked, because remember, Maimonides is always rational, always reasonable. He doesn't like magic or superstition in any way. He wrote against astrology when a lot of other people believed it and so on. He says the reason why God asked for animal sacrifice, he was trying to wean the Israelites from pagan practices. And they sacrificed people. And he knew that they couldn't just, boom, like that, not sacrifice anything. So he allowed them to sacrifice animals as a way of gradually drawing them away from human sacrifice. Now, traditionalists didn't like that answer by Maimonides because it suggests that this is a concession to human weakness as opposed to what God needs. But that was Maimonides' answer.
I actually, up to a few weeks ago when I asked this question, I felt exactly the same way about, you know, the message is
right.
To stop. But again, I go back since you brought it up. You know, if this was, and I know the answer, you said that, well, you know, it's 5,000 or 3,000
right.
years later, we're still reading and we're getting a lesson. But if the message was for people in those days, they didn't have this book to read. Yeah. Why was this done so privately? If this was a message to, you know, whatever, you know, however number of masses
right.
of people, why wasn't this done in a public place? So
right.
this way they would get the message, you know, not...
Okay, the answer of the book is God tried the public thing with the Tower of Babel and with Noah's Ark, and it didn't work. And so God's trying with a specific people if their stories and their whatever will spread out, and you could argue that it worked. Because after all, the Bible became the foundation of Christianity and Islam. So it's, I would say, you know, that some of the greatest changes in the world are things that are done very privately and very secretly. And, you know, you have, I don't know, Freud meditating in his office or speaking privately to a patient. He writes a book, it changes the world. So there is an argument to be made for one-on-one being more effective ultimately. You know, it's God's a great networker. But it's a great question. Yeah, hold it. Yes? No? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, when you mentioned about with the Rambam saying
yes.
It was kind of like a concession to human weakness,
It reminded me of, I don't know if it's similar, but when a woman is captured in battle,
right. Great analogy. Yes. That is, when you capture a woman in battle and you want to make her your wife, first you have to shave her head, you have to keep her there, you're not allowed to touch her in the attempt to make you send her back. But if not, because the Bible knew that basically, and this is still true today, men in battle rape women indiscriminately, and it happens all over the world and always has, in an attempt to limit that, rather than saying, okay, it doesn't matter how you conquer, you can't touch a woman, which would be so... so extreme a rule that no invading army in history has ever obeyed it. Instead, they try to make it more, I mean, look at what's going on even today with Japan and sex slavery. That the Japanese government, 50 years later, is still not admitting what everybody knows, which is that they took all these women from China and elsewhere and Korea and used them as sex slaves for soldiers. The truth is the Bible solution was much more humane.
The Quran says that it was Ishmael.
Yes.
So I'm just curious to the extent that
you're aware of that. Oh, yeah.
The variation.
Well, I'm going to get, I have to call now Reuven Firestone. Remember last year I called him, but he was in Egypt. I have to call him and see if he'll come to the class and talk about the Islamic traditions here, because that would be great. So I'm glad you reminded me. I'm going to do that. Yeah.
The message of the Bible is for all of us, and it could go on and on, it's universal. So if that was the message to stop human sacrifices, what are we supposed to learn from it right now, today?
Right, which I think ties into what Mark was saying. So I would say, I mean, in the course of studying this, that's why my first kidding answer to Norm was real. I don't think that any story in the Bible has a message or two messages. I really do believe that it's the whole point of the Bible is that it's supposed to be constantly generating messages depending on the age in which you read it. So what we're supposed to get out of it today, you'd have to go back over all the things that we said to decide. It depends who you are. It depends what kind of parent you are. I mean, maybe the message for today against a God against sacrifice is what Eric Welsh says when he says the key line in this is don't raise your hand against the boy or do anything to him. In other words, it's a message against abuse hidden in the Akedah. So that's one possibility. For someone else, in the Middle Ages, it was clear that the message was, you know, that the sacrifice that you're making will ultimately be rewarded, as God did with Abraham. I don't know which message. I mean, I have to think back over all the messages that we've derived from it, but it clearly, to me, is a spiritually very enriching story. Even the fact that out of this story you would get a message about the way you treat animals is a powerful thing. You know, when Amichai writes that the real hero of the Akedah is the ram, that's that poem. You know, it is endless that what you can get out of it. But I don't have a specific one. That I think clearly not the human sacrifice one, although in its time it was important. So. All right, next time we're going to actually move on to chapter 23. And if you want to hear more about the Akedah, once again, Tuesday night, Shavuot at 7:30. Is there class next week? No, it's Shavuot. No class next week. Right.